everybody, and welcome to the Frontside Podcast, episode 75. My name is Charles Lowell, a developer here at the Frontside, and your podcast host in training. We have kind of, this is a little bit of a diamond anniversary episode, I guess, number 75, so you know it's going to be good. With me today is Jeffrey Cherawati. Hello, Jeffrey.
Hey.
And to celebrate our 75th Diamond Jubilee, we have with us a person, a very special guest who I like to refer to as the Eye of Sauron when it comes to bugs in the Ember community, Mr. Robert Jackson, who is a person over at LinkedIn who does what he thinks best. Hello, Robert.
Nice. Howdy, howdy. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Today we're going to talk about many things, but chief amongst them is going to be Babel.js and kind of the conversation around tooling in the JavaScript community, because we've come from a point where, gosh, I want to say in 2012, where it wasn't really a thing, or, you know, the build step was kind of like an incidental thing, but it mostly was just, you know, maybe compressing your files and maybe doing a little bit of fingerprinting and what have you, to now pretty much build tooling rules everything around us. The amount of software around the deployment of your software, it's a huge amount. Would you say that's fair? Like, we've come a long way.
I think for sure that we at this point have a whole Tower of Babel going on with all the things that we're doing, and we have a ton of tools at our disposal today that I wish that I had years ago. And I think that, unfortunately, the law of nice things is that as you get better things, you realize the things that you don't have still. So it's like an ever increasing distance to the promised land, if you will. But I think that where we are today is like massively night and day better than where we've ever been before. And we can do so many things like code mods and like live transpilation and prod debug stuff, like all sorts of things. It's, and for the most part, in the Ember community, at least, we try to make that as much like a default out-of-the-box experience as possible.
So just to talk about, you know, that land before time, now Ember was one of the first frameworks to really embrace transpilation, but, you know, using Babel as the primary tool. What was that experience like? What changes did we have to make in order to hit that?
I think we were Ember itself, the framework itself, which is still sort of shrouded in like the final globals output, which folks used, was one of the first major things to use ES6 modules. And at that point, it was before Babel was even like a concept, as far as I know. We started using Tracer. Then we also used the Square had written an ES module transpiler as well, and we were using that for a while, and it was like, it was great. And so as we continued to progress down this path, like, we realized like we wanted nice things in our apps too. We wanted modules. We wanted to get away from. So at the time, we were using like Ember AppKit. This is like predates Ember CLI. We're using Ember AppKit, and the way we got modules was either via Rake pipeline, which was a Ruby thing in Emberside, or just like some grunt pre-compilation, which roughly just ensured that the modules were evaluated in the right order, and people generally actually wrote global style code and just assumed the concatenation order worked. So that's like super not great. It made for some really gnarly like interdependencies that like was hard to untangle, I suppose.
Where did Babel come in that conversation?
Shortly after we started doing Ember AppKit, this was like a project that Steph Penner started. We started doing ES6 modules specifically, as at the time we were using Grunt for that. And we did modules. I think we used Square's ES Next or Square's ES6 module transpiler. And then shortly after started working on Ember CLI itself, like the tool named Ember CLI that you know today, we migrated to a tool called Esperanto from Square's transpiler. And then that was deprecated, and we started using Babel. So we have made many many hops along the way. And I think when we originally introduced Babel into the Ember CLI app pipeline, it was an optional dependency because it was actually quite slow to run Babel across a decent size app. Like, it was like many orders of magnitude slower with Babel than without. So some folks wanted to opt out or optionally opt in to using Babel. I think over the years, so that was probably sometime in 2015. So over the years, we slowly started like migrating the code base so that at this point, Babel is totally required part of Ember CLI build pipeline. And we will warn you or something if you don't have it. But yeah, so it started out as basically an optional dependency. And then we've worked along to add like caching, multiple caching layers, which is also pretty trolly sometimes if you get it wrong, and sort of speed up like the cross restart caches and all sorts of stuff to make it so that we could remove the performance penalty of build on the build side of using Babel and just like have nice things and be able to rely on like the ES latest version of JavaScript in our apps.
It sounds exhausting, but thank you for jumping onto the JavaScript fatigue grenade. Like the number of the number of technologies you just like listed through, like it is there's a lot going on kind of at the front lines.
So I don't know that we've always done a great job of this, but hopefully the idea is that we should insulate most Ember users from having to make all these sources themselves. Like, we are doing internal things. We expose specific public APIs, and most Ember apps could upgrade from amongst these very from Square's Transpiler to Esperanto, then to Babel, like mostly seamlessly. Like, it just drop this thing in or do that thing. Just basically add a package to your package JSON, and it kind of should work. Like, that's the idea. So hopefully no one else had to deal with quite the level of shenanigans that I was talking about, and hopefully there's only a handful of people that remember all the names that I already listed. So
yeah, I remember I remember them happening, but you're right, we were relatively insulated from all that. I think the hardest part was making the mental leap from going to from global oriented code over to modular code, where every symbol has to be imported before you can use it, and bridging that chasm, I think, was the work that the majority of developers had to do. And it was no small task, but clearly it was worth it. So, I guess the question is how have you decided, obviously there's a lot of benefits to using ES6 modules, but there's other things, because it's a full transpiler, you've got a lot of features like the modules that you can either take or you can leave. How do you decide which ones to turn on by default versus leave off?
So the way that Babel itself internally did this in version 5 of Babel is quite different than what Babel 6 does. In Babel 5, they roughly took the mindset of, we'll just transpile everything that is past stage 2, which is the way they rate where things are. Like, stage 2 is ready for a browser implementer, stage 3 is like roughly finished and stable, like you can consider it stable. So by default, Babel in the Babel 5 version era was just transpiling everything, and you could opt into special like experimental things, maybe like spread operator or decorators or something like that. Or so that's how Babel 5 worked. Now in Babel 6, which is the migration we just underwent in the Ember community, going from Babel 5 to 6 was like a huge leap for us, because it turns the whole thing on its head and basically makes it so that each and every transformation you want to use, you have to opt into manually by adding a plugin. They also added presets and things like that.
So literally every transpilation you want to
use. Yeah, exactly. It was a quite huge shift, and that's also why it took us so long to upgrade from 5 to 6.
Was the upgrade, again, pretty transparent for the end user, or are there some...
So if you weren't using experimental features, like decorators, for example, the upgrade was roughly like yarn upgrade Ember CLI Babel done. That was basically the upgrade. Now, there are people that got bit by specific bugs or specific things where maybe they had a custom plugin that they were using that was like for Babel 5, and they would have to upgrade that also. But by and large, the default out-of-the-box Ember app from Ember CLI, the app generated by Ember CLI 2.4, we tested all the way back to 2.4 and made sure that version of Ember CLI Babel worked for all the versions and hops between 2.4 and 2.13, which is when we finally released it.
Okay. So about this, kind of turning this on the head, why was that decision made to make every single transpilation optional, opt-in?
I didn't have a seat at the table at the time with the Babel folks, so I'm not quite sure exactly why it was done. All I can say is that the The main reason that, as I understand it, had to do with plug-in ordering and making it so that you had the ability to much easier opt in and out. For example, the way we migrated to Babel 6 in Emberland was by using Babel preset env, which is a preset maintained by the Babel folks that essentially takes a list of targets, similar conceptually to like auto prefixer or something, and says,
What is auto prefixer?
Auto prefixer is a thing that will post-process your CSS and add the like random browser prefixes based on the list of browsers that you support. In Babel world, this basically means we give Babel preset env a list of browsers. So you might say IE11 plus. You might say latest to Chrome's, latest to Safari, latest to Edge or something, right? Firefox too. You give us this array of what you support, and Babel preset env uses an internal database that's also the same thing that powers the caniuse.com. And it just decides, what do I need to transpile to target these specific browsers, right? So, for example, if you only support browsers that natively support like Promise or something, you might not need that polyfill, for example.
Right.
That's just a crude example, but another one would be like arrow functions.
Okay, yeah.
You know, or classes. Or
so whatever. I noticed this. I actually noticed this yesterday as I was on the Babel.js site, and I remember it used to be when you would type something in that left pane, you know, your ES6, it would always generate this really nasty thing that like boiled down to prototype code, you know, where you're manually adding methods and stuff to prototypes and sometimes using define property and what have you. But I noticed yesterday I would enter in like a class and it would just be a class over on the right. Like it didn't touch the code at all. It just passed it through. And is that because the preset environment is now the one that they're using to do the transpilation on the demo site basically is set to the level of browsers that understand class constructs?
Yeah, so class is one that's supported by, like, if you can forget about IE11 for a moment, which some of us can, some of us can't. If you can forget about IE11 for a moment, all of the Evergreen browsers, plus Safari, which I don't think is Evergreen, all support class and, like, arrow functions. They all support a huge swath of ES6 out of the box by default. So if you only have to support, like, you know, Edge, Chrome, Firefox, and Safari, maybe Opera, I don't know, then you can like transpile way less stuff. You can use native classes, and the Babel.js REPL lets you choose what to transpile back to. I can't remember if they're specifically using Babel preset env or not, but that's the basic idea, which is what you're getting at.
Okay, I see. And so does that make it faster? Because it has to do less work?
So it does less work, for sure, but also in the browsers, for example, with Chrome, when they were doing the TurboFan migration, which is like the internal VM, JavaScript VM that they just migrated to in Chrome 59, when they were doing that migration, like they were basically only adding optimizations to the new syntax. So they had stopped working, modifying, changing, like optimizations for like ES5 style code, and were only really adding things like to optimize the ES6 stuff. So you're going to get the like class, for example, is much smaller by bytes than the prototypal version, right? It also provides some additional guarantees, like you have to call super, for example, right? Things like that. And then, in addition, it's just better optimized or has the potential to be better optimized in the browsers than the ES5 version because they can make specific assumptions about the patterns you can follow.
These are all big architectural decisions that changed how Babel works. How do these change the workflow for somebody working with Ember CLI that doesn't have anything particularly custom going on?
The workflow should basically not have changed in any way. Like a default out-of-the-box Ember CLI app from version, I think Ember CLI 2.12 used Babel 5, and then 2.13 started using Babel 6, like for the blueprint. And anybody could upgrade, like add-ons, for example, could upgrade to Babel 6 as soon as they were ready. And the reason for this was because each layer in the Ember CLI app pipeline is responsible for transpiling its own code that it owns. This is how, for example, we were able to upgrade to Babel 6 in a minor version bump because it was essentially opt-in only. So again, each add-on, for example, got to say, I will use Babel 6 now and vet that their add-on works and do their tests and all that stuff. But by and large, a normal app should only have to upgrade the one Ember CLI Babel package and then any Babel plugins you might be using. And that's it. Like there shouldn't be any other special shenanigans or hoop jumping that you have to do.
And so do you have any kind of even anecdata surrounding how much savings you get in terms of payload size?
Well, the problem is that Ember itself still supports IE9. Which doesn't have any features of the good things. And also, Uglify has significant problems with ES6 code. So we're still sort of struggling through the woods of getting a good set of targets built up. The default set of targets that we include for a new Ember app still includes IE9 because that's what Ember supports. So you would, in your new Ember app, you would have to edit the config/targets file and remove, just configure how you'd like it, right? Basically, last two Chrome, last two Firefox, last two Edge.
So let me just let me just stop there, because I think that you just mentioned something that's of key interest when you said config targets. Does that mean that every Ember application comes with a stock set of targets that's changeable?
Yep, exactly. So I wrote a blog post about this, actually, at rwjblue.com. It talks about the targets and how this was introduced and how it works. The default stock set of targets is also listed in there. And I have a bunch of tips and tricks about how you can maybe have local development only say latest Chrome, so you can have native generators. You can step through your Ember concurrency things and actually not have to see the wacky regenerator switch statement, right? All of that stuff. And so I talk a lot about that in this blog post. And so basically the config/targets file that is generated by a default Ember app today has some list. I think there's four things in it, but it includes IE9 as the oldest thing. That's the tent pole, if you will. But if you drop that out, then it's roughly evergreen browsers only, and you can target classes and arrow functions and all sorts of stuff, have that actually emitted.
Wow, that's incredible to be able to do that. And I know that certainly when it comes to debugging, it is so frustrating to see the kind of mangled concatenated code.
Yes, without a doubt, exactly. I mean, just imagine the thing that just blew my mind when I first got this working was just being able to step into an async function and just step over, step in as appropriate without having to jump to weird RSVP land or weird back burner code, run loop code or something. It just works, and no regenerator, no extra polyfills, It is the promised land is gorgeous. I don't know where we're going to get there, but it is beautiful over there.
Yeah. Although I do have a question. This has been something that I know has been a challenge when it comes to working with, especially people who are beginners, having the code at runtime not be in the same form as it is when you're developing it can be a wide cognitive gap that you kind of have to straddle as a developer. And, supposedly source maps are there to help us with that. But I've noticed, source maps don't always work and they feel a little bit fragile. If something's not configured quite right, well, then the whole source map chain breaks down and then you're back to looking at mangled code and you're I'm not totally free from ES5 because I have to understand how it's compiled down. And a similar situation would be if I was in Ruby code or some other language, having to kind of still understand how it mapped down or be able to how it read out as assembly, even though I don't think it's quite that bad. But you still have to kind of hold that mental model, and you have to understand what a prototype is. And is there any way to address that, or what's the deal there? I guess I know that's a really open-ended and question, but.
Yes. So a few things. So I totally agree with you. I think that there's a number of angles, and I'll try to list them, but I'll probably do a horrible job and meander in the woods for a little while. So just rein me in when you're ready. But basically, I think there's a few things. So first of all, I don't think I remember a time in JavaScript space where you ever actually had the thing you're talking about, where you saw the code you developed and actually ran it in production. For me, personally, since I've been involved, we've always done minification. Which broke that, right? So
right.
Unless you're running minified code locally, you're already out of that zone, right? Even if you have no Babel, you have no other transpilation, you're almost certainly going to minify, right? So that's already sort of like a problem, a chink in the armor of doing both things. Minifying locally during dev is theoretically fine. It's just it's going to make your life very miserable. But it should work technically. Like there's ways in Ember/CLI to do that out of the box, like you just set a flag. But generally, so that's already a thing. I think source maps are massively brittle, as you mentioned. Almost anything can do a just slightly wrong thing, and when you're when you have a file of like 1,000 lines, just having something be a few characters off is quite bad by the time you get to the end, right? Like,
yeah,
you can easily like have a debugger in a place and you think you're stopped at one section, but like you hover over the symbols or something and they don't show what you expect, right? Or you're just not in the function you thought you were or something like that. A great example of this is like if you've ever put a debugger in a Twiddle, embertwiddle.com, and put a debugger like in app code in a Twiddle, you'll get a breakpoint and the row that's highlighted is not the debugger line and it's like really breaks my brain. So you know that you're stopped on the debugger, but because their Twiddle does all of the compilation client side, like in the browser with Babel, and then it like evals it essentially, the source maps are totally wacky. And you have this exact situation that you're talking about where it's like, I don't know how to reason about what is happening, right?
You just have to use the console.
So in that case, you have to use a console. I think the most common thing for me to see or to tell people is to disable source maps. If you have a thing where you believe source maps might be right or might be wrong, the easiest thing to do is like disable source maps, refresh, and then you know you're looking at what's actually being evaluated. But that's like a super sucky answer. That's like roughly like, I had this caching problem. Well, just don't cache things.
yeah.
That's not a great answer, right? Like you should just fix the bugs. So the issue is that the bugs lie at the feet of literally every tool in the space. And it's really hard. Like, for example, if you Babel before Uglify, are you supposed to give Uglify the input source maps? So the answer is yes, but Uglify oftentimes doesn't handle input source maps properly. So it won't do the right thing. So then there's tools like Sorcery that is essentially a thing that's like, just have each step only do their own source maps for like so from raw code to Babel and then from the Babeled transpiled code to minified code, and then you give all those source maps to Sorcery and it tries to like stitch them back together and make them work. It's a really neat tool.
That
actually
sounds amazing. It really sounds like the only real solution.
So that's the only solution to solve the like threading through of all the source maps thing, and it actually works quite well. So unfortunately, the problem with that is that now you have to like track the order of all the things, and that's all actually non-trivial, right? Especially in like an Ember CLI app or an app of any significant size where you have like thousands of files and you're transpiling them, you have to basically keep track of the source and then the concat stages independently. And we don't have a good mechanism, like back channel, if you will, to keep track during the pipeline of like what the order of operations are and how to stitch all of the source maps back together properly. But I totally agree that this is not a wonderful place to be. And, we just need to spend more time, focus. We basically need to do two things. We need to say we all agree that this is unacceptable and we actually have to be willing to invest time to fix it, right? It's just too easy to uncheck the little checkbox that says source maps and move on about my day. And it would be better if we just like dug in and dealt with it like we would any other bug.
Yeah, I think it's hardest because this one in particular, it hits beginners way harder than everybody else because they don't necessarily have that transpiled mental model.
Well, and the other thing is, like with lots of things, if it only sporadically works or only sporadically breaks, it just completely destroys any trust you might have had with the thing, right? Like basically, if your test suite mostly passed, how well are you going to feel about deploying, right? Like, it passes 8 out of 10 times, it's probably okay, right? Like, that's not the kind of confidence that you want with these tests, right? It's the same sort of thing, right? So if your default answer is, maybe the bug is the source map bug, right. So let me uncheck the thing and refresh, you either should just never use source maps, or you should just, like, fix the damn problem, right? Figure it out and fix it. The issue is that almost never is the thing I'm trying to work on related to source maps. The thing I'm trying to work on is like some other bug in some other system. And I'm like, God damn, I just want to like figure this out. Right. Like, so you end up getting like 3 yak shaves deep and you have to, at some point, you have to declare yak shaving bankruptcy and give up, pop the stack. Yes. Yes. Good. Wow. I am absorbing that one. That's great.
That's called Yak Overflow.
The thing is, if we can only harness the yaks and like convince them to build things for us, then like it'd be amazing.
Yeah, each layer is a yak frame. Yeah, they're a good beast of burden. I think so. It would be, you know, if in terms of like allocating, you know, developer resources, if you could track the number of yaks that were required to accomplish each task, you could say like we this is a really high value yak to kill or to shave, I guess.
We don't want to kill them, right? Come on, they gotta carry our stuff.
Yeah, and if the land of the future, the promised land, is, you know, wrapped in, or it's built with yak wool. Well, anyway, moving on. So we have a question from Twitter from one Rob DeLuca, and so he wants to know about what's going on with Ember decorators and ES6 classes. Like, when are those going to make an appearance in Ember?
So Ember decorators is a add-on that that I authored roughly forever ago, it seems like, but not quite. And there's been a lot of work on it lately to sort of update it to work nicer with Babel 6. And we also added support for classes. There's a whole bunch of work going on in the Babel space to upgrade, so update things to the latest spec of decorators. So back when I originally wrote the add-on, this was in the like stage one version of the decorator spec, and like a massive amount of things changed in the spec around what was allowed, what wasn't allowed. It doesn't change a ton on the user-facing side, so like the way you invoke a decorator with like, you know, at adder or something is roughly the same, but the internals of like how they're transpiled, what syntax is allowed and not allowed, that all like went through a lot of changes.
Didn't they also? It used to be you could decorate things more than just classes and methods.
Confirmed. Yeah, exactly. So,
and I actually was kind of disappointed that they walked back from that.
So I agree, actually. It is slightly unfortunate that you can't decorate like a Pojo, for example, today, or with the current spec. The thing to remember is that it's really important that TC39 take the most conservative approach and then iterate forward, especially with like this sort of massively shifting technology. Like, decorators are like a big change in the way you think about things. Same as like class properties and private fields and all these things that are sort of coming out of TC39 these days. If we started too broad, I fear we'd be painted in like a giant corner, right?
Right.
Also, as an aside, like the syntax of decorators is nice, but if you just wanted to decorate a function, you could just wrap the function in a calling function, right? Like, it's not that complicated, right?
That's the same thing. That's just what a decorator is, right?
Except for in classes, it's actually not possible to do that, right? So in classes, the class body, you cannot say foo colon ember computed and pass a function, right? You actually have to have the concise method syntax, right? So for plain functions, you could easily just wrap it. For classes, you don't have a choice.
Or you have to do what Ember object does, which is just take a hash and then construct the methods by hand. But yeah.
Yes. And so unfortunately, if you do that, then you can't use getters and setters, right? If you do that, you can't, because when you define like get space, you know, first name or something, you're actually defining a getter on that hash, that Pojo, and Ember object will just eagerly evaluate it when it goes to instantiate your instance. And that is definitely not what you wanted, right? You know, so there's all sorts of like landmines in there, and there definitely are dragons, I promise. So the good news is that I think we're going to a really good place. The Ember decorators add-on was recently renamed from Ember computed decorators and now offers decorators for like action. We've had computeds and observer and on for quite a while. And I think service inject, like controller inject, but don't do that. Things like that. Those all exist as decorators now. There's a nice API doc site link from the README. And like most of these things work nicely. And the wonderful thing is that you can basically use class syntax today with many objects in Emberland without using Ember object dot extend. You can do like class foo extends Ember object, and most things work really nicely. There's a handful of edge cases that we need to sand down and sort of fix and deal with, but it's a really, really exciting path. Like basically just to like embracing real JavaScript syntax now that we have good class system, and we can sort of start shying away from some of the bizarreness of the Ember object model.
So even though, you know, the thrust is towards using ES6 classes, under the hood, is it still going to be instantiating an Ember object?
So the nice thing is that Ember Object itself actually just embraces like ES5, and you can already imagine like a class, a regular class foo extends bar, already can extend from anything that is like a prototypal type class as well, right? So internally, Ember itself, Ember Object or Ember Component or Ember Service, all those things are basically just prototypal like classes, right? So extending from them works exactly the same as the like normal like, you know, function foo, set prototypes and stuff like that, right? It's exactly the same as the prototypal version in ES5. So there's some edge cases, some things that we added on top, like things like mixins, for example, which are kind of gnarly, and the resulting JavaScript class system does not have mixins. Well, it doesn't have the mixins in the way that we think of them in Ember. But you can easily imagine writing a mixin decorator or something that does the work, either assigning the properties from the host objects or just making a chain of extending classes, so you actually have real super in those. Like, all of that is quite possible. There's an open issue on Ember Decorators repo that someone opened, I think, just yesterday or 2 days ago, about like adding a mix-in decorator. And personally, I would prefer to hold off landing that, because I think that I want to see how far we can take like normal class syntax, like normal class stuff. And I think that the next thing that we'll probably need is like an RFC in Emberland to officially embrace using regular classes for these things and explore all the edge cases and stuff that we're sort of ferreting out in the add-on.
If you have regular classes, then you can use kind of regular math, regular mix-ins, like the JavaScript, you know, functional
exactly.
Mix-ins.
Totally. And you should totally be able to do that. But I just don't think that we should support ember.mixin mix-ins, basically, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I don't think I've ever written a mix-in that I didn't come to regret later.
I tend to agree. I would like to like ban creation of all new mix-ins.
Yeah. Yeah. It anyway, that's a whole nother
can of
worms.
Another topic, yes, exactly.
So behind the scenes, we're getting an Ember object, essentially a new Ember object that extends this class, if I understand correctly, that's generated and decorated, but it's an ES6 class, and then kind of behind the scenes you get an Ember object that extends it. One of the things that I think is another big challenge is, you know, because Ember objects are not regular POJOs, they're really hard to inspect in the debugger. You know, computed properties are kind of a no-go when you just log it to the console. Is they going to clean up a little bit of that?
Well, so there's a few things. So first of all, being able to use plain class syntax means that that we can use real getters trivially for the things that we don't need some of the magic that Ember Computer is doing for us. It's not magic, but still, like hand wave internals. There's use cases that people use computed for, which is roughly that I want to lazily do a thing. Which isn't really the point of computed, but sometimes people like don't want to eagerly do it. They only want to create some array or something if instantiated, for example. And then they rely on the fact that the computed is cached or memoized, right?
Right.
It's like massively trivial to do that yourself in just a getter. And if you do that, then you can use the normal JavaScript dev tools to just inspect the object, right? You don't need some magical thing that knows how to call ember.get to retrieve the instance value, right? So I think that the answer is roughly that it unlocks those things, but it doesn't provide them by default. So as of like the thing that Ember Decorators add-on does today, it really is just creating a regular computed property on the instance. But I think once we embrace classes, once that like using classes is public API in Emberland, like from the Ember project that says, yes, this is the thing you should do, and we like start updating guides and stuff. There will be an RFC for that. Once we get there, then we can start figuring out, well, maybe how do we make the ember.get requirement go away, right? And when you do that, you're talking about moving to real getters. And if we can move to real getters, then all of your normal debug tooling will just work, right, out of the box. So things like that. I think that's the path. But I think there's many stepping stones, if you will. Like, we're going to try to roll it out in small chunks over time so that it's not too hard to digest, and we can slowly iterate the way we teach folks the guides and things like that. All of it, like, we have a lot of things to move forward at the same time.
Yeah, I know another thing too is being able to see the actual name of the class in the dev tooling when you're trying to track down memory leaks. When you're logging to the console, being able to see that if you're just using an ES6 class, like say I've got a class named person, today when you log it out to the console, it just says class. Or if you see it in, you know, if you're doing looking at a heap snapshot, it just says class. But hopefully we can get to a point where it'll say person, or it'll say car, or it'll say dog.
Yeah. And I think that specifically will require some of the target stuff that I was mentioning, right? Like, because it's only going to work when you're actually using classes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I think we're close to the point where many apps already don't have support IE11. I think we're like, as it continues to age out more and more, usage will drop away and we can start embracing like evergreen only style browsers.
Right.
And when we're there, then like basically everybody supports class. Basically all of them support arrows and async await and all sorts of nice things, right?
Actually, I think that in that particular case, if it's a function, even though it transpiles the class down to a constructor function, the browser will still recognize it. Because that's something I've noticed today, like when I'm using Pojos and when I'm using Ember objects. Is the reason it's called class is because literally you say like var class when Ember creates the constructor.
Right, but the reason for that is because that's so in Ember in the source raw source we use it is using the class keyword, right? Like it's actually using class, but we transpile it down to because Ember targets IE9, we transpile it down to like wacky land basically.
Right.
So once we can use targets, then we can basically remove the extra layer so that you're actually using classes even at the depths of the internals.
Okay.
So we would basically just have to remove, like it would not set a variable. It has to be a named class, basically.
Okay. You have to give a name to the class.
Right. And I don't think now.
Because right now it's basically because the variable name, it literally, you know, is var capital
exactly.
class.
Yes, it is not.
That's the name that the class gets in the runtime.
Yes. Wee.
So so there's a lot to look forward to. So when it's always a dangerous thing to ask people, you know, when can we expect this? And I don't want to put any pressure, but when do you see these things kind of rolling out? Don't you love how you always preface a question with like, now I don't want to put pressure on you, but I'm going to put pressure on you.
So I will give the stock answer that I always give, which is you will get it when it is ready and you will be happy about it. But that last bit was more for my kids, actually. But anyways, so I realize that I am on record here. I think that a good window for this is something like the 6-month horizon. Maybe slightly longer. It's hard to say exactly. Like we have to do, like I said, we have to do an RFC. There's a small amount of work has to happen in the Ember internals to unlock a few of the things that the RFC needs to say. But we, the Ember core team has talked about this pretty extensively. Like we have, we're all generally plus one. We all obviously want to do the thing. The question is exactly how far we go. And my personal perspective is that we should do small steps, like unlocking small parts at a time. Like, for example, we can go to class syntax and say that it's public API to like implement a constructor function instead of like init, for example, and say exactly what the semantics are around that. And we can do that roughly independently of like actually officially embracing a specific set of decorators, right? The decorators are fine to live in add-on space for a period of time, right? Like as we mature them and figure out which ones are good, which ones we want, like what do we not want, that kind of stuff, right? So I'm a strong advocate of doing the smallest amount of things possible to unlock the feature, unlock the things, and then we can iterate forward as we go. And along, we're working on updating the guides and making things more idiomatic in the API docs. And like there is a massive amount of literature that exists between the API docs and the guides that will have to be like rethought, right? Not always rewritten, but like we have to make sure that what it's saying is the actual idiomatic right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And like embraces the language, right? Like, so from my perspective, I think it is a huge, it's very, very important. It's a huge priority because I think right now, one of the things that I hear from folks is that like the custom object model makes Ember feel like a dinosaur, right?
Mm-hmm.
Partially because like we had to create all these things before any of this existed in language, right? And our dedication to supporting like backwards compatibility is like really important. So we haven't just dropped support for all the old things. So we need to chart a nice path that lets everyone sort of meander forward and upgrade their apps, and no one gets stuck on a cliff. And I think that's like really important to do and do slowly over time in a consistent way.
Yeah, no, I think that thoughtfulness is something that's the key to the castle right there, is that you aren't just throwing away backwards compatibility and thinking about what is the migration path for everybody. You know, people lose that as being way more valuable than having the hottest thing in your hands. And unfortunately, only being burned by that can make you perceive it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think people just going on the like hype factor or the ooh shiny factors, it's easy to forget that this shiny thing wasn't so shiny a year ago, 2 years ago. And if you had written something a year ago, 2 years ago, you would have basically been totally screwed. And it's easy to forget those things because you're like sucked into this like sort of the JavaScript fatigue thing, right? Like you're sucked into like this really like, ooh, there's a shiny thing now, I want that. And and I think we just need to do a better job of telegraphing our emotions, like where we're going, like talking about the direction in a more like sort of like overall roadmappy way in Ember. So it's clear why can't I use classes today? Or what are the edge cases? Or, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. So hopefully in the next little while we'll get that RFC up and we can start talking about these things in earnest. Right now with the Ember Decorators add-on, and you can look at the API docs of that. But basically with that add-on, you can totally use regular class syntax today for for the vast majority of things that you'd want to do in an app. Like you could do class extend service or something, and it works just fine. And vast majority of things work. Again, we have edge cases like things in component space, for example, like attribute bindings are very hard, or tag name.
Mm-hmm.
Those are less trivial, basically, because in Ember, attribute bindings is essentially a concatenated list of all the attributes that we're going to bind to. And there's no concept of that in in the normal sort of JavaScript space. So I believe we should be able to do this with a decorator, but also in like sort of if we get to the promised land of having like Glimmer components and whatnot, it may not matter anyways, because that whole thing of attribute bindings and tag name and class name bindings and class names and classes, all of those properties go away, and we can just use like normal handlebar syntax, which is right. Going to be great. The other things, so I linked to them but I wrote two blog posts about things that we're doing at Ember CLI Babel. The first one was targets. The second one was about debug code stripping. So if you basically have assert or deprecations in an add-on or app code, it's automatically stripped the same way that Ember does. But those are the kinds of things that that are unlocked by having like shared Babel tooling and stuff.
Thank you so much, Robert, for coming and talking with us. It's the amount of knowledge about JavaScript and just everything in general that's contained in your head is just so massive. I feel rich just having gotten to experience a little bit of it in the past 45 minutes or so. So thank you so much. You're going to be talking, I understand, at EmberCamp London.
Yep, that's next week, on the 11th. So that is coming up quick.
All right. So everybody look for that. We'll link to that in the show notes. Also, be sure there's a lot of extra stuff that we didn't have time to talk about specifically around this topic that Robert's written about on his blog. So be sure to check out those links. We'll see you around.